Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. This is Scout Smith, and Kadada will be calling in a little later. She has some stuff going on out there in the political universe that she's trying to take care of today, so she'll be off and on with us today. But today's show, we had originally planned to talk to Harrison Floyd, who was going to be running for Republican. He's a Republican. He's going to be running in Georgia House 7. He's African-American or Marine. And we were going to talk to him about the district he's running in out in Gwinnett and Forsyth County here in the state of Georgia. But he had a family emergency, so he's not going to be able to come onto the show today. So we're going to reschedule that interview, and hopefully we'll be able to talk to him, because here on Down South and Dirty, we want to make sure that we are talking about issues from all sides. Even though we are personally on the show, you know, progressives, left-wing Democrats, we want you to be able to hear from the other side directly as much as we possibly can about what they're thinking and how they plan on governing, because we might get some nuggets, you know, and not living in a bubble is really good for our cases of trying to make change here in America. Well, so since we can't talk about that today, we decided we wanted to talk about something we have not talked about on this show in a while, which is the case for impeachment. So we're going to be discussing that somewhat today. So when we get into that segment, I want you to do something that you have not done in quite a while, that some of you do every once in a while, but I really want you to take time today and call in. If you're listening, call in. Tell us what you think about impeachment. Because some of these stories need to be told from the perspective of the grassroots, folks who are not necessarily on the, you know, the inside of what's going on politically and whatnot. So that's something we want to discuss today also. But we are also today going to talk about our presidential profile. You know, we didn't mess them. So this week we're going to talk about former Colorado governor Hickenlooper. And it's going to be really interesting, because Hickenlooper was just with everyone else out in California at the state committee. So Governor John Hickenlooper is going to be our presidential profile for today. So let's get to it, and let's start talking a little bit about, when Kadada come in, we'll talk about the presidential profile. But let me start off on the premise about impeachment. We all know that we've read the Mueller report, we've listened to his testimony. A lot of us have wondered this whole idea behind what we say, the idea that you can't indict a sitting president. And the constitutionality, from what I'm being told as I'm having conversations about this with people who are a lot more learned in this part of politics than I am, is that the reason why you don't indict a sitting president is because if a president commits a crime while in office, it is the Congress's responsibility to charge him and adjudicate that case. It isn't the Justice Department, because why? The Justice Department works for the president. So it's a check and balance to keep the situation which we're seeing now, in which you have an AG who is basically, you know, caping for the president. You want the check and balance to come in, which would be the legislative branch. Now, if we get through the impeachment hearings and the trial was actually to go to the United States Senate, the presiding officer over that impeachment trial would be the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. But a lot of us don't necessarily understand the process of impeachment, and maybe that's where we're going to start at. We're going to talk about how that process rolls before we even get into how or why we should, okay? So here we go. Now, I know a lot of y'all do not see, in the academic universe, see Wikipedia as being a source, but what it does do for me is it combines all those sources, you know, into one area. And it, for most part, when I do my research to go parsing out to find out where their sources come from, it's been pretty accurate for me. But this is what Wikipedia is saying. So if you are sitting in front of your computer or have your smartphone in your hand, you can read the same thing that I'm reading. But the impeachment in the United States is a process in which the lower house of the legislature is going to bring charges against a civil officer of government for crimes that have been committed, analogous to bringing an indictment, and it's similar to bringing an indictment to the grand jury. At the federal level, this is the discretion of the House of Representatives. Most impeachments have concerned alleged crimes committed while in office, but there have been a couple of cases where people have been convicted for crimes prior to taking office. The impeached official remains in office until the trial is held. That trial and the removal from office, if convicted, is a separate act of impeachment. It's separate from the act of impeachment itself, and it's similar to the trial before a judge and a jury. And these proceedings in the legislature are conducted by the upper house, which is at the federal level, it's the United States Senate. Now, where they get this power from is Article 1, Section 2, Clause 5 of the Constitution grants to the House of Representatives the sole power of impeachment. And Article 1, Section 3, Clause 6 grants the United States Senate the sole power to try all impeachments. In considering articles of impeachment, the House is obligated to base any charges on constitutional standards specified in Article 2, Section 4. The President and the Vice President and all civil officers shall be removed from office on impeachment of, for impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. Now, I'm going to stop and I'm going to click into that, because there's a whole point. What does that mean? You know, what does that mean? So here in the United States, you know, high crimes and misdemeanors. Here it is. From Article 2, Section, for Article 2 of the Constitution, high and legal in common parlance in the 17th and 18th century of high crime signifies activity by or against those who have specific duties acquired by taking an oath of office that is not shared by common persons. A high crime is one that can only be done by someone in a unique position of authority, which is political in character, who does something to circumvent justice. The phrase high crimes and misdemeanors, when used together, is a common phrase at the time the Constitution was written and did not require any stringent or difficult criteria in determining guilt. It meant the opposite. The phrase was historically used to cover any broad range of crime. The Judiciary Committee in 1974, when they was talking about the historical origins of impeachment, stated that high crimes and misdemeanors have traditionally been considered a term of art, such as other constitutional phrases, such as levying war and the word use of the word due process. The Supreme Court has held such phrases must be construed not according to modern usage, but according to what the framers meant when they adopted them. Chief Justice John Marshall wrote in another such phrase, it is a technical term. It is used in a very old statute that a country whose language is our language and laws are the substratum of our laws. It is scarcely conceivable that the term was not employed by the framers of our Constitution in the senses which has been affixed to it by those from which we borrowed it. Because, you know, again, a lot of the language we used at the time of framing the Constitution naturally was things that came from English common law. So we think about the terms high crimes and misdemeanors and think about in the way that language was used in the, you know, 18th and 19th centuries. You know, if you listen to that language, some of it is very colorful. I know us Southerners are used to the very colorful language of the antebellum South, which borrows a lot of its, you know, its phrases and inflections of how we say things from Great Britain. You know, it's the whole aristocratic, you know, feelings and pretenses that comes from there, of being landed gentry and whatnot. However, we go back to talking about the high crimes and misdemeanors. Again, it says this is something that is unique to this position. I necessarily cannot commit high crimes and misdemeanors to the point what the president could do, because the president can commit crimes that none of us that are the vice president or people who are impeachable can commit crimes that we can't even conceive of because of the office that they hold. I mean, there are things that, you know, let's say the head of a corporation could do that was perfectly cool, perfectly ethical, but from a point of government could be considered a crime. And we got to sit back and think about how leadership has different responsibilities and how those different responsibilities then play themselves into what's right, what's ethical, and it takes in the process of getting the job done. And, you know, this is one of those things we have to think about on leadership at all levels, particularly those of us who are operating in political spaces. We have to be very careful of how we act when we're governing because we're held to a different standard. I know I watch inside of, you know, party politics. We have different we have different leadership levels, and it's sometimes you have to teach people that guess what? You can no longer do and say things or react to things in the way you did when you were just a member or you were just a regular citizen. You're no longer regular. You're held to a higher standard. You can't do what everybody else does anymore. And people say, why are you worried about what people think? No, because you're on a different level. But that is the crimes. You know, it's high crimes and misdemeanors. You know, it goes into a lot of different things. So, I mean, you can have a president who, one of the things that it was given an example of is you have perjury of the oath, abuse of authority, bribery, intimidation, misuse of assets, failure to supervise, dereliction of duty, unbecoming conduct, refusal to obey a lawful order, chronic intoxication, and tax evasion. Offenses by officials also include ordinary crimes, but perhaps with different standards of proof and punishment for their non-officials on grounds that more is expected by officials by their oath of office. Now, I want you to understand this. This is, again, let me go over that list. We're talking about perjury of oath, abuse of authority, bribery, intimidation. Let's hold on that for a second, the word abuse of authority and intimidation. We got a president of the United States who doesn't have to say certain things. We just know how he feels about something, and people make action. Just like in his trip to Japan, how we hear that, you know, the USS John S. McCain had to have his name covered up because it would cause the president to have a hissy fit. People are intimidated by the fact that he might have a hissy fit. I mean, really? Y'all scared of the man? You can't go around having a, we have a president of the United States that people are scared of. You know, conduct unbecoming. People don't look at that, but, you know, that's kind of where we went to when we were talking about impeaching Clinton. When they went through, it was conduct unbecoming. You know, because the president of the United States is held to a higher standard than we, the people, are. So, again, we're talking about impeachment, the grounds for it, and what's the constitutional implications of impeachment. So now we're gonna talk about high crimes and misdemeanors. So we understand what that. I'm hoping that we kind of gotten at least a base idea of what that means. Okay. So again, this is a constitutional act. Follow, you know, and it's supported by several clauses in the Constitution. And again, let's read, I'm going to read Article 1, Section 2, Clause 5, which states that the House of Representatives shall have the sole power of impeachment. Article 1, Section 3, Clauses 6 and 7 says the Senate shall have sole power to try all impeachment. When sitting for that purpose, they shall be on oath or affirmation. When the President of the United States is tried, the Chief Justice shall preside. No person shall be convicted without the concurrence of two-thirds of the members present. Judgment in cases of impeachment shall not extend further than the removal from office and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States. But the party convicted shall nevertheless be liable and subject to indictment, trial, and judgment according to the law. So this is very important because we understand, we've always had this question of understanding what was the reason why the DOJ will not indict a sitting president. Because Article 1, Section 2, Clauses 5 and 6 states that judgment in cases of impeachment shall not extend farther than removal from office and disqualification of office, trust, or profit, and the private. But then that once he's removed from office, it makes him liable and subject to. So this is alluding here that before this, the interpretation is that they're not liable and subject. Just reading that last line, but the party convicted shall nevertheless be liable and subject to indictment, trial, judgment, punishment, according to the law. once they are convicted. So to get the president to a point where they could indict him for any of the crime that he may have committed, the Congress must then impeach him to take him out of office, therefore making him eligible for indictment. Now, going back to the whole talk of crimes, high crimes and misdemeanors, we already can see several. We just talk about the fact that conduct unbecoming, we're talking about intimidation, abuse of power. So we already have things that we can go after. Okay? Now, Article 2, Section 2 says the president shall have power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment. So he can't free himself. Okay? Article 2, Section 4, the president and vice president or civil officer of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for a conviction of treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. See, that's where the high crimes and misdemeanors come in, because that takes and puts him responsible for his conduct as president of the United States. So, when we get to talking about the whole idea of the process, you know, we're going to have to go through and the procedure. And there's a three-step procedure, which I think is the reason for why the Democrats are, hold on, we got Kadada is finally here. Kadada? We're trying to get on. You got a little slowness going on with the computer.
Hello, I am
Kadada, hey.
Hey,
all right, we're going.
I've just been listening.
Okay, so far, am I explaining this in a way that you think that they understand me?
Honestly, I don't think it matters. And here's why. I don't even think the articles of impeachment really matter, because I think what's more important is public perception. And
right.
I don't think that Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, and all of them really care. They know, right? The powers that be that could pull the trigger, they know. But I think that what is really fundamentally at heart here is history. And if
right.
anyone has ever taken the 10, 15, 2 hours to actually read up on or listen to some great podcasts out here about Richard Nixon's impeachment process, that would give everyone a little bit of pause as to the necessity to impeach and what the public thinks about it. Because when you try to impeach a president, their ratings actually increase. And no one, even though there's people out here that feel like, okay, he has to go, there's a whole other side
right.
of individuals that are going to be, they're going to take a sympathetic and a very empathetic ear to the fact that here's this man having to endure this in addition to all of his other responsibilities. And the Democrats cannot risk his favorability rating increasing. They just can't, because then
right.
that, at that moment,
right.
they lose. And that is fundamental, I think, in terms of why this avenue to impeachment is something that should not be the number one course of action. And you and I spoke
right.
briefly. I know there's an article out that said, you know, current progressives, and a lot of them are younger than us. I'm 43, so my current progressives, somewhere in their 20s and 30s, they need to go read
right.
progressive history, because you have
right.
to understand, how do we get here? How did we get here? Why are actions taken? And I'm not too sure anyone's reading anything other than here's what
right.
I feel like at the moment, and here's what I just think that we need. We just need to get rid of him. Well, there's a
right.
there's an effect that what happens to getting rid of him. Honestly, I do not want Mike Pence's crazy, conservative, Christian ass And, excuse me, Lord, I don't want him to be the president because I think he's crazier than President Trump. We just don't see it.
And actually, crazy, and actually probably more intelligent.
I'll give him more intelligence. I would be the sigh of relief on intelligence.
But this is the thing. You know, a lot of people historically have said that one of the reasons that, you know, the American public has always taken the stances they have taken when it comes to us even possibly talking about impeachment of a president is because we, out of all of the things we talk about in the Constitution, you know, the impeachment process is the part in civics class where you are taught the least about. We all understand right. Now, because we were all, you at some point in time in your education journey in the United States, you will learn about the Bill of Rights. You will, and even then, that's scant because we learn about the first, about the second. We might get some, we'll get a taste of the fourth, the fifth, and then it's kind of like, okay, what about the rest of them? Because you
now,
know,
wait
you
a
have,
minute.
You
Hold
have your
on. I don't want to give too much credit because I think that honestly, I never learned about the Bill of Rights in my United States schooling. Never. So my understanding, like even just how a bill becomes a bill, that was from the little video that everybody knows and we could all sing the song.
Yeah.
So I've never been in a class that actually taught the Bill of Rights. And so or I've never taken a true government class. Like, you know, my daughter's now 20.
I know we touched on it here in school in Georgia. You touched on it in history class when you talk about the American Revolution. And you talk about the framing of the Constitution. You will talk about it then. You may talk about it if you have a civics class, which I did. I had an actual civics class as a part of one of my electives. And then it was an elective. It wasn't a core course. It was an elective where we talked about it. And again, when we did talk about it and we talk about the Bill of Rights, you don't ever really, like I said, we don't talk about all 10 because, you know, I get caught up on, I know the first, I know the second, I know the fourth, I know the fifth. You know, all of us know about the fifth because when we don't want to say some shit, we'll tell you, I plead the fifth. And we really don't even understand the fifth. But we know we understand the first and the second because we fight over the first and the second all the time here in America. You know, we fight about it all the time. You know, if you are a libertarian or Republican, you love the tenth. But I've always said that leftists need to pay attention to the ninth because the ninth actually says all power is not enumerated to the state or the federal government is given back to the people. And I think if we would, you know, this is a whole other conversation for how we get to talking about certain rights that we are fighting for right now, such as reproductive rights. It may be best fought under the ninth than anything because the government should not be telling a woman what to do with her body because that's an individual right that should be given to herself, and the ninth would support that. But again, we don't know enough about our Constitution.
Wouldn't the ERA be closely aligned with the Ninth Amendment too?
Right. It would kind of bolster that. But you know, again, we don't know enough about our Constitution sometimes to be able to even effectively roll through that. We don't know enough about a lot of documents that govern different things in our lives to effectively use them. Me and you talk about this all the time, and we talk about organizational governance and how very few people who find themselves in leadership have even read Robert's Rules.
Oh, Lord, yes.
So,
everybody, go read Robert's Rules of Order. It is one of the best books ever.
So anyway, this is the same thing when it comes down to the Constitution. A lot of people go based on the urban legends of what the Constitution actually says. And this is why I was going through the procedure of impeachment and talking about what impeachment was, because I don't know, thank you, I seen when you came in that you had been holding for about 3 minutes. So I don't know if you got into, I talked about briefly what high crimes and misdemeanors were. Because,
right.
you
yeah.
know, people, you know, and it was, and the language behind it and how it comes out of the 18th century and, you know, high crimes or something only that somebody in a high office can commit because of the unique nature of the office. And one of the things
now,
that is considered a high crime or misdemeanor is abuse of power, intimidation,
right.
and conduct unbecoming. Those are considered high crimes.
But those are,
and
but
so
that, here's
under
the
that
challenge
case,
that we have with
woo.
That. Here's the challenge that we have with that. That those terms are so fluid, and they're subjective.
Right, but then the Supreme Court has ruled, but the Supreme Court has made a ruling on the language.
Uh-huh.
It was actually John, Chief Justice John Marshall made a ruling, and I was reading about that and reading it to the audience. He made a ruling on that because basically, like he said the same thing you said, that those words are subjective to, you know, in modern usage. However,
right.
if you so if the Supreme Court has always interpreted that language based on how the framers would have used that language in 1787.
So how would they have used it in 1787? Because the way I
the thing, it comes
in
from
modern
English common
language,
law.
Okay.
You know, it comes since it's the high crimes and misdemeanor phrase actually comes from English common law. Again, it is
which
based
all of
on
our
the fact
laws are
that
based
the person.
On English
right.
common law.
Most of our laws are based on English common law. Most of them are. Unless you live in Louisiana, then it's French code.
It's French.
But so anyway, and it is the Napoleonic French codes. Now, but with the high crimes and misdemeanors, because the only people that could be charged under English common law with high crimes and misdemeanors were the people in the royal family and the prime ministers and members of parliament. It wasn't
makes
something
sense.
The lord makes and sense. The lords and ladies, the aristocracy. Now, because
mm-hmm.
they had their duties and responsibilities were different than the common man. There were certain things
right.
that they could do that a common man did. If I committed the crime of intimidation, it really didn't really. I'm a nobody. Who can I really intimidate? You know, but if I'm the lord of a manor. If I'm the duke of so and such, if I'm a prince, if I'm the prime minister, my intimidation of someone could actually have implications that could be global.
Right.
So, therefore, again, let's say, and I use the example of, for our present president, is that people know how he feels about certain things.
Mm-hmm.
And so they know he has a feeling about something, and they've seen him go into a tirade or a temper tantrum before about something. It doesn't even take him to say a word. It's just they know he's finna come into contact with something that's gonna piss him off, so they will do something about it without even him saying. Case in point, the shrouding of the John S. McCain, USS John S. McCain.
Oh my gosh, that is
he
so
said
petty.
He didn't
and
say
I can't,
anything.
He's petty.
Everybody.
Yeah. Okay.
Right, and so nobody, you know, everybody said no. The president didn't say anything direct, but we know how he feels about this. You motherfuckers, excuse my language, were scared.
Right,
you were scared. You were actually scared of what the president of the United States would do if he saw a name. That is something that you wouldn't be scared of if you know. Oh, screw Scout. He'll deal with it. But when you got the president of the United States, who we know as a volatile human being, getting pissed off about some words of a name of a dead man.
Man, yep.
That has consequences that could be devastating to the nation. If we don't know what you're gonna do.
So where would that fall?
Puts him in a special term. That will fall under high crimes and misdemeanors under intimidation.
Okay.
Because
the American public.
So this is what the thing is. We talk about petty. When we
right.
talk about petty among
yep.
regular folks, it's not dangerous. But for a leader to be petty is dangerous.
Oh, of course.
Think about
it.
Let's reach all the way back. Let's reach all the way back into antiquity. Let's reach back into the days of the Roman Empire. We've had Roman emperors who their pettiness started wars.
Of course.
People died because they were being
petty.
We've had in modern times, let's use a couple of dictators that we all know about historically. I'm not going to go with number one dictator, number one of the 20th century, because we all, we overuse Hitler's name too much. But
right,
I would
so
go
got
with,
Kim
let's
Jong.
Say, yeah, we got Kim Jong-un, we got,
Kim Jong-il,
what's his name?
His daddy, the son.
What's old boy? Papa Doc Duvalier.
Papa Doc. Yep.
Let's talk about Charles Taylor. Manuel Noriega. Petty for them means
Gaddafi.
People die. Gaddafi.
Yep.
Well, we can.
There's a little bit, but that's a whole other conversation.
Because we understanding that we looking at him through American eyes, and we give it the
exactly
Gaddafi from African eyes. There's a little bit of difference there, but there are certain individuals on the planet that we kind of all agree. I've not met a Haitian yet that has said, "Oh, Papa Doc Duvalier was great." And if I ever hear one saying, they probably belonged to that government and was making gangbuster profits.
And was making money. Yep.
Yeah. But the thing is that type of pettiness is dangerous to a democracy. And that is why the words high crimes and misdemeanors, when they interpret it, that's why those crimes are interesting, because they are not something that a regular person could do. And then we get into the problem as we also reading into that, and I was reading a couple of the articles, and I was talking about, and I'll go back, to give you a refresher of what I was talking about, and it was back in article, it was article 1, section 3, clauses 6 and 7. We all wondering why we can't indict a sitting president. Well, article 1, section 3, clauses 6 and 7 basically give you the understanding of that. Toward the end, it says judgments in cases of impeachment shall not extend further than to removal of office and disqualification to hold and enjoy office of honor, trust, profit of the United States. But the party convicted shall nevertheless be liable and subject to indictment, trial, judgment, and punishment according to the law. So based on that, what the Constitution has said, that person in office was not subject to or liable to any of those things until they were removed from office. So this is why Mueller was saying, I can't do nothing about this because Congress is going to have to say he obstructed justice.
Then you
can remove him from office, and then you can, anything else that he may have done, we could then bring up an indictment on it then. But first, impeachment must take place.
This begs the question. So you have states like New York State right now that are asking and finding ways for him to turn over his tax returns, right?
Right.
If they find misconduct, because they know that there has been some type of financial misconduct in regards to his nonprofits and his foundations and whatever else that he has going on over in New York State, does this mean that when they find something, because they will find something, does that mean that they cannot press charges against him while he's still in office? Waiting? Okay, that
they
means no, they
wait.
Cannot press charges
they
on
would,
him. Okay.
Right, they could not, because that's an indictment.
Okay.
Indictment is formal charges.
So then,
the thing is, they would have to wait.
Do all this?
See, this is the question. See, now, if you go through the process of impeaching him, and we can actually get the 2/3 votes through the Senate to get him
mm-hmm.
out, you can impeach him earlier. But this is why you hear some Democrats say, beat him at the ballot box. Because what will happen is, if we were to win the election in 2020, on January 20th at 12:01, you could then officially drop an indictment on the former president of the United States, Donald J.
Right.
Trump, and have his ass put in cuffs the moment that damn Joe Biden moves into the White House.
I'm fucking with y'all.
But y'all look, and everybody probably like, Scout, you shouldn't have did that. But I'm being funny on the Joe Biden thing. But whoever the Democratic president would be to replace him would basically be like, lock his ass up. Now, the thing is, the optics for that would be disturbing to certain groups of people in this country. And this is the thing that I started to come to conclusion with, because I have been up to this point a person who does not believe that we need to go through the process of impeachment, because it will cause a level of unrest in the country. However, I also now believe that if we were to win the election in 2020 and he gets indicted at 12:01 on January 20th, it again will cause unrest in the country.
It's
about right now. So it's a question now. We finna have unrest. So the only way there's not any unrest is him winning in 2020, and that is not going to be good, because that just kicks the unrest down to another point, and who starts it at that point?
Well, let's Let's talk about that, because I think it's important to note this concept of unrest, because it's not we're not talking about, like, people just kind of go off into the corner and cry, you know, when he won, people were devastated, people were crying, people were shocked for two, three months, all kinds of stuff. We're actually talking about, we think that people will actually pick up arms and go to war over the fact that their beloved...
If it's not open warfare, it will be acts of domestic terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
So, and understand that, you know, we might not get enough people together that they can actually get an armed conflict. But we in America have dealt with domestic terrorism before. But we've never really, you know, had a campaign waged where we had Timothy McVeigh or Eric Rudolph running around regularly blowing up shit.
Mm-hmm.
Killing people. Hell, we could be in a state of terrorism now. We just keep calling it mass shootings and don't want to connect the dots. But we could be in that process now.
Yep.
So my question is, okay, do we continue to cower in fear because we are not wanting to have this situation, and we just keep kicking this can down the road? Because if conflict is going to happen and we're on that trail already, it is nothing we can do to stop it. But what you can do is control it. And that means we do our duty. We do what we know is right. We do what we need to do to make sure that we at least control when it starts, how it starts, and start planning for it, and being accountable to the actions we're going to make it. Because this is why I was going into talking about the procedure of actually getting the impeachment done, and this is one of the reasons I think even Pelosi is starting to do it. Think about it, because the first step is the Congress investigates. And this investigation typically begins with the House Judiciary Committee. It could begin somewhere else, because like with Nixon, it started in the Senate. And with Bill Clinton, it started with the investigation of the independent counsel. Okay? But there got to be an investigation. And so this is what they are talking about now, is the impeachment investigation, because right now they're trying to do investigations around the Mueller report, and the president is constantly telling them, no, you can't do this. No, you can't do this. But if it's an impeachment process, then the rules change. These subpoenas start having more power behind them, and can get locked up, because then you are impeding justice.
Right.
You know, he actually get pushed into he could actually get pushed into a situation in which he obstructs justice just because he want to be an asshole. And not realizing, because he ain't that bright, and you push yourself into a situation instead of just cooperating like Bill Clinton did, or resigning like Nixon did. Okay, now the second part of this impeachment process is the House must pass by a simple majority of those present voting the articles of impeachment, which constitute a formal allegation or allegations against the president. Then there, at that point, the defendant has been impeached. Okay, so Bill Clinton was impeached because the House actually passed those articles on him. He was impeached. But
yeah, I think people don't believe he was impeached.
Right, but he was. Because, see, that's this misunderstanding. People think once you impeach, you are removed from office. If you didn't remove
from office,
but what people tell is that the impeachment and the removal are two different acts. Now, the third thing, the third procedure is the Senate tries the accused. The case of impeachment of a president, and the Chief Justice of the United States presides over that. So the impeachment of any other official of the Constitution is silent on who should provide, who presides over that. But in the case of the president, it is the chief president. It's the chief justice of the United States Supreme Court. Okay? Now, the conviction in the Senate requires a two-thirds vote. And if convicted, then that person is removed from office. That is the part that we keep discussing, because it's like right now we know we don't have the votes in the United States Senate to get to two-thirds. We might have the votes to get to a simple majority, but two-thirds, that's 60 vote threshold that we always talk about. That you know, the same thing that the filibuster nuclear option shit, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about getting into that 60%, that 60 vote area. We're talking about 60-something votes. And, you know, if we really want to go into the total two-thirds aspect of it, it's probably, 66 votes? Since there's 100 of them, that's 66%, that's two-thirds. So, you know, we get to talking about that. Now, I'm not going to get into it. There's a whole bunch of rules and procedures that are here that actually govern that. But people need to understand, impeachment in itself is just the House saying, we pressing charges.
Right.
Those charges now, and the thing is that once they press charges, Mitch McConnell has no choice but to try the president. He don't get to do it like he doing everything else. We're not even gonna bring this to the floor for a vote. That's not even gonna happen. If he even tried that, that's a constitutional crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And see that right there is the point in which you can have the idea what sparks some of this conflict, because if Mitch McConnell says I'm not gonna do it, who then can force Mitch McConnell to push that vote?
Right.
Does it push us into a constitutional crisis where the rest of the Republicans are like, you know what, for the sake of the damn country, we got to get rid of Mitch McConnell, and they take him out as House Majority Leader? And if that happens, do they then get bold enough to get to a two-thirds vote? Or do they stand obstinate too, and then the House attempts to go pull somebody, because there's some rules in there about arresting other members of Congress and now. And so then, who do you send the Capitol Police over there to go arrest? And then where do you put them?
The entire Republican Party?
Who then adjudicates over that?
The entire Republican Party?
Exactly.
Okay,
exactly. That sounds crazy. So what that looks like to you? That looks like Fort Sumter.
Happiness.
Oh. But it looks like Fort Sumter. That's the shot at Fort Sumter right now. So you have all these different things that kind of say, are we ready to go there? But this is why we talk about voting like we do. This is why we talk about civil engagement like we do. Because this is why we talk about the political pettiness at our level that is dangerous. Because I hear people already talking about, so-and-so is nominated, then we're going to go vote for Trump, or we're not going to go vote at all. That is that selfish BS bullshit that comes from so-called progressives that sit there. You're selfish because you think what is good for the nation is so great, so perfect, that you're willing to put our whole destinies, a whole nation's destinies, hold that hostage because of what you want. You're not even willing to compromise. That shit is just as dangerous as Donald J. Trump. And I am a freaking progressive in saying that.
But that also reflects, I'm going to put it out here, some of the ages of some of the progressives reflect how they were raised. Some of them did not learn how to share. Some of them did not learn how to think collaboratively and some of them were able to throw hissy fits and get through life that way. And that is just something that's honest, that's factual, because I've seen it, and that type of behavior is dangerous. That's when moms have to put your ass in time out and go sit down somewhere until you get it together.
Right.
But we know
and we have to learn that we can't operate like
that. But they want, but see, that's a skill, right? To go, we either have to be collaborative. That also means that here's the skill. Everybody's not going to win. Everybody's not going to get selected. At some point in time, you have to understand that your candidate may not win. They may not get the nomination. So the next step is, guess what? You go with the nomination for the best of the party, for the best of the country. I saw an article this morning, and it showed, I guess Bernie Sanders did a rally, and it discussed how there were so many people at this rally that it actually went across to, like, the government steps, you know, the steps of the government house or whatever, the city hall or whatever. And whoever it was, y'all can be mad at me, whatever, I can't remember who wrote it down, I wouldn't say their name anyway, said, and what did the poll say? And I thought to myself, wait a minute, we cannot be this basic of understanding how things work. Just because someone took a picture at a rally does not equate to, in the poll, how many people said that they would vote for Bernie Sanders. But you have people who think like that, right? Then it's not even a rational thought to believe, okay, 10,000 people showed up to a rally, so therefore the polling is incorrect. We love Bernie. Thank you, Bernie, but I don't understand why people don't seem to understand. Bernie's not a Democrat, and I don't want to have a big conversation about Bernie. He ain't a Democrat. He's a Democrat on paper because he has to check a box to run, but he's not a full-fledged Democrat. Is that the only – am I the only person that sees that? But okay, whatever. We can move on.
So we have this problem of why – impeachment in itself can be problematic if we don't do it right. And I was just happening to be, we were talking about history and understanding it. Now, we know there have been two presidents that have been in, which articles of impeachment have been issued to the United States Senate. They are Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton. Now, the first president in which an actual impeachment investigation was launched on was James Buchanan, and it was for corruption. And they met for it was, and there was a, the Covode Committee. It was established on March 5th, 1860, and submitted its report on June 16th, 1860. But what happened is the committee found that he had done nothing wrong to warrant impeachment. But history has come back and said that his administration was probably one of the most corrupt administrations up to that point since the framing of the Constitution. So, and we've had numerous judges that were pointing that when Andrew Johnson was impeached,
Who is Andrew Johnson? I have no idea. I've never heard that name before.
Andrew Johnson was president of the United States. He was the vice president of Abraham Lincoln.
He's
the guy that took
over after
Lincoln. And he violated the Tenure of Office Act. The Supreme Court will later state and then repeal that the Tenure of Office Act had been unconstitutional. So the law that he was supposedly broken, they found out that it was unconstitutional later on, and then they repealed it. So I'm finna actually go see what that article was, because I'm like, I didn't know that's what they impeached him for. The Tenure of Office Act was federal law enforced from 1867 to 1887. It was intended to restrict the power of the president to remove certain office holders without approval of the Senate. Basically, what they were doing is that when Johnson took over, and this is one of the things we have to realize, that Johnson was not a Republican.
his Lincoln actually had a Democrat as his vice president. Johnson also was not, he was a Southerner. If I'm correct, he was a Southerner. So the Republican that were in charge at the time were very scared of Andrew Johnson because, one, he was a Democrat, and two, he was from the South because he was born in North Carolina, but he was, when he was elected, he was from Tennessee. And it was one of the few, this is one of the few cases in which you have a president and a vice president that were from opposite parties. Because, Nick, you know, the president can actually choose whoever the fuck they want to run for vice president with them. You know, and that's how that ran. That's how you did it. But Lincoln had picked Andrew Johnson in an effort upon election to try to hold the country together. It was a fusion ticket to do that. Because nothing in the Constitution says that the President of the United States and the Vice President have to be from the same party. It just, you know, that's how they roll. But, okay, I'm trying to see this here.
See what?
Okay, so, no, I was just, I seen your message.
Yep, so I've got to run to the listening audience. I've got to run.
And I will continue. Now, if anybody is listening to the show right now, and got anything to say, it's 646-787-1657. Call in, you know, tell me what you're thinking. If not, I'm going to continue on this lesson. Probably, since, you know, since Kadada's leaving and me talking on by myself, that might push our show to at least 11 times. But, you know, this might be a shorter show. And we've done this before.
Oh,
y'all don't listen. Y'all don't seen this happen. Because me just talking to y'all for 2 hours, I ain't going to get it unless I get some interaction. But yeah.
Well, we all know
so
Scott likes
go ahead
to talk,
and do.
So it's not like we're not going to lie.
Yeah,
we
but,
you do. So, I mean, I love you for it, though. But I just want to tell everybody, next week I will give you an update because I'm heading into a meeting. There is a new organization coming to Georgia, and I'm going to that initial meeting, and I will share what's coming in the political world. And so you all have an awesome Sunday, and I will talk to everyone soon.
All right,
guys, have a good time. All right, bye. Peace.
So, as I was saying, you know, we have this, you know, this tenure off of that, and they were attempting to keep him from doing his job. So there's historical references to different things which have caused us to go into impeachment. So impeachment is still something that I'm kind of skeptical on, but we may not have a choice in whether or not we are going to deal with this. We're either going to keep kicking this can down the road, or we're going to have to face it up either way. None of the outcomes seem to necessarily be a win-win for just a this-go-stop resolution. There's going to be some pain. There's going to be some suffering. There's going to be some instability, because this is what happens when we don't pay attention in our electoral process and we allow our emotions and some of our thinking, to use a phrase from one of my family members who happens to be a bishop, that he he likes to use the phrase thinking. And that's Bishop Jerome Dukes. He lives down in Fayetteville, Georgia. But he uses that a lot in his sermons, the term thinking. But we have to get ourselves prepared that this is not going to be an easy solution. We don't put ourselves in a position in which, regardless of which way we turn, we're going to find ourselves somewhere we necessarily may not be comfortable. We're going to find ourselves outside of our comfort zone. But I'm going to go back now, and we're going to talk a little bit more about this process, because I think, you know, listening to what people have said, listening to the talking heads, listening to those individuals who are learned and academic, and I'm in somewhat agreement with them on this. Now, I'm going through here. Now, there's been a lot of the trial phase, which I think where we would get hung up. Now, in the trial phase in the United States Senate, it is actually a trial in which the president the president will have the right to call witnesses, and the House, who are the ones who are actually calling for the impeachment, would have to have witnesses and cross-examinations. So the House members, who are given the collective title of managers during the course of trial, will present the prosecution's case. And the impeached official has the right to mount a defense with his or her own attorneys as well. Senators must take an oath or affirmation that they will perform their duties honestly and with due diligence. After hearing the charges, the Senate usually deliberates in private. The Constitution requires a two-thirds vote, a two-thirds supermajority, to convict a person of being impeached. And so, we're talking about this number of what the two-thirds majority is. Excuse me. And in the United States Senate, I'm not getting the number here, but I think that's 66 votes. Yeah. And abstentions and absences are excluded from that. So that means that it's amongst the voting members, and that's interesting. Because you could go in there and, ooh, that would be ugly. The folks just start saying, I'm not voting, but you got two-thirds of the members that actually vote. Ooh, that would be ugly. The Senate then enters its judgment on its decision whether to convict or acquit, and the copy of the judgment is filed with the Secretary of Secretary of State. Upon conviction of the Senate, the official is automatically removed from office and also may be barred from holding future office. This trial is not an actual criminal proceeding, and more closely resembles a civil termination appeal in terms of contemplated deprivation. Therefore, the removed official may still be liable to criminal prosecution under subsequent criminal proceedings. The president may not grant a pardon in an impeached case, but it may result in a federal criminal case. So what we have is that in this case, if the president was actually, when we took it to the Senate, there will be cross-examinations, there will be witnesses called. It would look like a trial in that aspect. And if there was, then they would go into voting. They would necessarily be the jury, whereas the chief of Supreme Court is the judge. They would come back with a decision. Then we would give that to the Secretary of State. Trump would then have to move his happy ass out of the White House, and we would then do an oath of office for Mike Pence, unless at the same time there was an impeachment trial that went after Mike Pence at the same time. And then after that, we would put then that puts, you know, and if Pence was then also impeached and convicted, then the
oath of office will be given to Nancy Pelosi, and she will become president of the United States. So, yeah, y'all see where that would happen, right? Y'all see where that goes. But, I mean, there's a lot to unpack here. And so, there's there's a lot that we have to think about when it comes to whether or not we should go ahead with this. Now, I can understand, you know, getting the investigations done, this, then the other, getting all of the truth out, but we have to think about what is this going to do to the country as a whole. How would an actual impeachment trial and proceeding affect our economy? How would it affect our foreign relations? All of these different things, because the President of the United States is still the President of the United States. So we got to really think about that. So right now I'm opening up the phone lines, 646-787-61657. So anybody want to call in, this is the time to do it. Say what you got to say. If not, I'm going to sit here for another. While we're waiting on calls, I'm going to do our presidential profile for the week. And this week's profile is on John Hickenlooper. John Hickenlooper is Colorado's former governor. He's 67 years old. When he left office in January, having created 400,000 jobs over two terms, with unemployment dropping below 3% in 2018. The state currently boasts the number one economy in the nation, but this is also in part to a fracking boom. Hickenlooper markets himself as being a centrist who can bring opposing interests to the table. And I'm getting all of this from an article. I'm reading you an article from Rolling Stone. and they have a wonderful ranking system, in which right now they got Hickenlooper ranked at number 18. And he basically told Rolling Stone, "I am who I am," true to that North Star. So he's very focused on who he is. He raised $1 million with the 48 hours of his declaration. For those who are big, his big thing has been his ability to get his state government to pass background checks and have magazine capacity limits on weapons, which that's kind of, you know, when we're thinking about what happened in Virginia over the last week, just before the weekend got started on Friday, that's kind of an interesting concept that he's one of those people who've actually not talked about gun control and but actually got something done. One of the things that made me laugh, because it's also dealing with gun control, is that Rolling Stone has what they call a signature apology for each one of these, most of them. And in 2014, Hickenlooper apologized to local sheriffs for not consulting them before he started pushing the gun control measure. They didn't like it, and they kept pushing him on it and kept talking about it and this, that, and the other. And then, so one officer kind of just really pushed the limit on it, and Hickenlooper says, "How many apologies do you want? What the fuck? I apologize." And he was like, you know, he was frustrated. And I liked him. I'm like, "Wow, I like that." He said, "What the fuck, really? Like, I don't say it. I'm sorry. You want me to keep kissing your ass?" Basically, that's what he was saying. So I kind of enjoyed that. Now, you can go to his website. It's hickenlooper.com. And I'm pulling up the website now so I can kind of describe it to y'all and tell you about some of the issues that he supports and this, that, and the other. But you know, and I wish Kadada was still here because Kadada has been the one who's talked about, she used to live in Colorado, so she talks a lot about Hickenlooper, and she's trying to get me to listen to a podcast in which they was talking about it. But you go to his website, the first thing you pick up is like with most of them, is chip in for the team today. You know, he got a donate up on the on a donate landing page. Then you go to his, when you go to his main page, you want your email address, you know, standard stuff. And he has an event thing going on. He has a quote that says, "When we stand tall for all we believe in and stand up against all that divide us, America will be stronger than ever." So, I mean, and that has been his big thing. He finds himself as a moderate. You kind of even want to, you know, as me and Kadada have been talking about it, he kind of stands as a in position of being, I would say, the other Joe. You know, because I would say him and Joe Biden so far, the one that are probably pushing closer to a moderate narrative, to how this, you know, how we should be trying to run America, that we shouldn't be running all the way to the right, nor running all the way to the left, that we should be, you know, trying to find compromise and standing up for our greater share of values. And in some cases, I can agree with that greater share of values message. But that's John Hickenlooper is the presidential profile for this week on Down South and Dirty. Now, there was two stories that that I was reminded that I needed to kind of talk about. One, this past weekend, I think it was yesterday, at the Move On Big Ideas Conference, in which the presidential candidates were speaking, we've seen this disrespect of Kamala Harris by this animal rights activist. And, you know, if you've been listening to Down South and Dirty, I am not a big fan of Kamala Harris. I'm starting to come around to some of her, to some of the, what she's saying and whatnot. And she has risen greatly up my list lately. I mean, she's like right now in striking distance of making top five, just because I'm starting to listen. But this is not more or less about Kamala Harris than it is about privilege, white privilege, because you chose to go on stage at a time when Kamala Harris was on deck talking about the issues, and you decide to go up there and take the microphone from a woman, a black woman's hand, and then proceeded to talk about your big idea, which what your big idea is animal rights. Now, I like the doggies, and I like the kitty cats. I like the hamsters. I like the gerbils, this, that, and the other. But let me say this, and if your feelings get hurt from saying this, I will never put the life of a dog or a cat over that of one of my fellow human beings. It's not going to happen. If I have a choice of saving a human being versus saving a dog or a cat, I'm going to save the human being. And sometimes animal rights activists, and I know some of y'all might get mad, y'all piss me the fuck off, because you will be well okay with some of the suffering that takes place in the human community, your human community, and you would cry over animal having to be in the same conditions. Y'all talk about, oh, don't leave your dogs outside in the winter, but I do not see you trying to help build homeless shelters for other human beings. Human beings do not have fur. They don't, you know, some of these animals are able to adapt. Oh, the animals, if there wasn't human beings, they would be living outside anyway. I mean, God created them to live outside. You know, we human beings are not very hairy. We've always had to seek shelter somewhere, either from the sun, from the rain. We've always had to do such. Now, with that being said, I do believe that we shouldn't be cruel to animals and that. But anytime we're talking about putting an animal over human beings, I think sometimes we can be a little misguided. And for this individual to go up there and start talking about his big idea, we had to do with animals,
I was like, okay. And then you just, so that's basically, you know, and I say this a lot of animal rights activists would give two fucks about a black person. They would give two fucks about an immigrant. They would give two fucks about anybody that doesn't look like them or who doesn't care about the animals like they do. And I understand the animals have no voice, this, that, and the other, but some of human beings around you don't have a voice. And so you, this guy to go take the damn microphone from Kamala Harris and go on his spout, I'm sorry. Now, I appreciated the two brothers that went up there and escorted him off that stage. But if it had been me and our security, bruh, your back would have been hurt. Your shoulder would have got dislocated because you just don't do no shit like that. I mean, it just doesn't work. That was disrespectful. It was a show of white male privilege. You know, you may call yourself not being a supporter of the patriarchy or toxic masculinity, but, and I'm a patriarch, and I will tell you that shit that you did was wrong. I would have never disrespected anybody on stage like that. I mean, if you wanted the debate or this, that, another, that was a question and answer period, you could have done that. And I understand activists do things, but that didn't further your cause under no circumstances. And then at the same time, let me also flip because, you know, as much as he was wrong, I see people are harping on the whole gender gap situation. Well, look at this, you know, white man, man. Yeah, we had certain sect, the same crowd was not mad when, you know, the young ladies with Black Lives Matter stormed Bernie back in 2016, or when they did it to Hillary Clinton. Now, being a white man doing it, it's wrong. So we really have to be, we got to learn that it either is all wrong or it's all right, or we got to come up with rules of when it's right and when it's wrong. And those rules have to be equally applied. So we got to think about that. Next, story. Kadada was wanting me to talk about this, and then we didn't get a chance to talk about it while she was here. And I'm thinking I might want to save that one. Kadada, I'm gonna save them because I want to. This was, it was about the little girl in Texas who her mother left her with the boyfriend, and then he claimed that they got attacked, and the little girl. And it comes to find out that he was suspect in this case. This, that, another. We really want to talk about how that dynamic is playing, and it's not political, but then it is, because, you know, we have politics inside of our families, inside of our community, and we started to, you know, Kodata asked me a question, you know, when it you going to be, for those of us who have blended families, when is it okay for your significant other to be left alone with your child? Or should they ever? And that's a very important question. And I'm going to hold off on that question to Kadada because I want some back and forth on that one. And maybe we can talk about this, maybe we'll be able to get some interaction from y'all because, I mean, I know that it's some of y'all and some of our, you know, listeners who listen to this show live, you know, y'all will come in and y'all chime in and whatnot on social media later, because some of y'all are cheating and listening in church or whatnot. But I want to continue some of the conversation that we're having. And so with that being said, we're going to end the show a little early today because I hadn't gotten any calls in. But let's continue this conversation online about impeachment. And also I'm going to post up a question the other day about that. And maybe we'll talk about, well, you know, the young lady in Texas. And we're going to post some questions, and hopefully some of y'all will come back and answer those questions for us, and we can have this discussion. This is Down South and Dirty, and we're out. Peace.
Thank you.